what I'd like to hear from you is what are the kind of ethical intuitions or categories which you are, which are motivating your identification of the major issues? Okay, what is it? I mean, there's something in this that's bothering you.
Yes.
And the one, and the things that you identify were the things that you would expect to kind of, well, that really pose a threat to the dominant liberal values, right? Privacy, autonomy, and equality, equal dignity, etc.
Yeah.
That's that set of liberal values. And so the question that this poses is, okay, is it that the technology is posing a threat to that fundamental moral framework, and that's what the problem is, and thus we ought to make moves that protect our ability to think in these moral terms? And that's the way I understand Habermas, for example, dealing with this in his book, The Future of the Human. Okay? In other words, we don't want to change ourselves in ways that make it impossible for us to be moral beings in this sense of what it is to be moral. Or are you saying that, no, that very set of values is not capable of dealing with this, with the new realities that science is presenting to us, that we need some other conception? And so then that lets me ask, okay, you promised us to deal with religion here.
Yeah.
And of course, if religion is usually associated with invoking some kind of essentialist view of nature based on the creation stories,
mm-hmm.
That provides a way of answering the question, is this thing a human being or not? And it's interesting that the article seems to anticipate that call in the Pope and the theologians, because they can examine this thing to see whether or not it's got the essence of that's sort of the underlying tone of that. So, okay, I said, can you kick us off by saying what's bugging you?
I'm not sure if I even know, whether it's just my instincts. Sometimes I try it by doing a thought experiment. How many, if we're just focused on not on the body for a moment, but the mind, because, as I said, we will have these capacities, if not the perfect capacity, but to change, to modify the biochemical pathways that produce things that determine how we think and feel. I mentioned this, we know this because of fMRI. We know that when we think, things light up. Well, if they light up, that means that there are biochemical transformations happening that are correlated. We know that. There's no doubt about it. In order to think, our neurons have to fire. Right? So let's focus on that. Take any one of us and say, we now have a palette before us, that any of these things of that we associate with thinking, feeling, learning, so on, is capable of modification. Is it quantitative or quantitative? How many of those changes could you pick from the palette, say, I'd like some of those, and still be one of us? How many? How far can you go and still, oh, that's still a human? So I wonder, I mean, is this, it's really hard. I mean, it seems to me there must be a point, ideally, and would you say, or a line that says, well, this far and no further, because what's over that line, I don't know what it is. So, if you think about the capacity to modify all those things for the organ which makes us distinctly human, namely our thinking and feeling brain, it is the thinking feeling brain slash, we know that from great books by Damasio and so on, the feeling of what happens. is it possible to say you could do whatever you wanted in whatever form and then would still be a human being? I don't think so. So I think there must be at least a minimum definition which says this far and no further, although I don't know what it is. But in principle, I think there must be, because what would that thing be if you had modified systematically all of those traits that we think of as human? So I find it in some sense as a kind of a prospect is to say, okay, we decide we're going to go down this route. And so this is that's the essentialist part, the pragmatic side is we go down this route and we get to a point and say, holy shit, this doesn't look good anymore. And we can't find our way back.
Who would be saying holy shit?
Whoever. And we can't find our way back. We don't know how to undo it. Go ahead.
I was just going to say very briefly on that note, and I didn't get a chance to read the whole article this morning. But as I read the news this morning, the BBC was reporting that a group of scientists in the People's Republic of China have successfully grown a human-animal chimera to 400 cells. It was an attempt to experiment with stem cell development. And they've terminated this thing at the 400 or 500 cell.
What was the animal?
I don't know, actually. I read the first three or four paragraphs.
I've got to have that. So
I will try and find it for you later, but just while we're on the topic of holy shit.
It's not accidental that it was China. There is a reference in the paper.
It was probably the same
scientist who had taken a human clone to the stage of several hundred cells.
Yeah, it wasn't an academic paper, it was the BBC, but anyway, how's that?
Okay. Yes, chimeras are very interesting. The chimera means two entities in one. It's from the Greek, the goat man, from Greek mythology, the Saturn. Yes.
All of this hits me very personally. My academic background is mixed. My first degree was in genetics and microbiology, and then I moved over to history of science.
Oh God, you should have said something sooner before I made a fool of myself.
And I teach women in science and medicine here, and so, what am I doing about it? 30 to 40 students at a time, I try and raise these issues.
Okay, so how would you answer?
My answer, and I think that we in the academy and we in society have been falling flat. We are educating scientists, and the way that we educate them is with a lack of arts options, right? Because you're trying to get through, you're trying to graduate, you're given a certain number of courses you need to take. You don't have to take history, you don't have to take history of science, you don't have to take ethics, you don't have to take any of this stuff. You can get through with a bare minimum of arts classes, right? You have to take English. And anything else is kind of your choice, depending upon your institution. So you're getting all of these people educated through with no sense of what happened in the 1930s. My dissertation is dealing with genetic anticipation. I've seen stuff in the 1930s in hereditary diseases. Huntington's disease, myotonic dystrophy, fragile X, all of these things. And so I'm seeing stuff in the 19-teens, the 1930s. I'm seeing it again in 2005.
What kind of similarities?
The kind of similarities, right? Is there anticipation in schizophrenia? Is there not anticipation in schizophrenia? The disease shows up earlier and oftentimes worse in succeeding generations.
Okay.
So in the case of Huntington's disease, if your father has Huntington's, right, his offspring have a greater chance of having Huntington's at an earlier age than their father did. Goes the other way with myotonic dystrophies. If your mother has myotonic dystrophies, because it's an expansion of trinucleotide repeats. So now we understand the mechanism, right? 1930s, they didn't understand the mechanism, and it was being applied a lot more broadly. So here we have scientists, right? They're not reading Penrose, they're not reading Haldane, they're reading the latest things because that's all they need to be educated. And at the same time, we're failing everybody else. Because the people in arts don't need to know what's going on in science. So I have to go right back to the beginning, as I didn't see Tuesday's lecture. I wasn't here. And as I assume you had to go right back to basics, right? Because a lot of the students in my class have no clue. And the way I bring it out to them is in the case of genetic engineering in terms of reproductive technologies. Mm-hmm. Because I see that as the first place people will be encountering this. Mm-hmm. And I do it through video and not through Gattaca, right? I use something else, something that's less science fiction-y. Mm-hmm. Because I feel this is really important, and we're failing on all counts. We're letting people go through who didn't have to take biology to grade 12, right? Who have no clue what any of this may mean, who are reading what's in the newspapers, you know, and not understanding the nuances. The Genome Project drove me up, down, and backwards because, you know, I understood exactly what you could and couldn't get out of it, and that's not what they were portraying to the public. You know, and then you've got James Watson, right?
Oh,
discoverer of the structured DNA, who says, well, you know, who's going to play God if we don't, on that lovely thing that just showed up on PBS last year. Right? That he
who's
sees.
By we, sorry.
We is in North Americans, right? Westerners.
I have on my website, I have a piece called Elementary, My Dear Watson, which deals with that. I mean, Watson, the co-discoverer of DNA, is notorious for his concept that we should pursue human perfection. We should change any trait. Why not? But he's also a notorious sexist, so there's a lot of thing in there about making women more beautiful. But it's very interesting. I mean, this is the guy who's at the center of it. And
he's running Cold Spring Harbor. He's
yeah.
You know, running one of the renowned scientific institutions.
And his fellow scientists, who should know better, who could call and rebuke him, they tiptoe around. I have an example of this. Tiptoe around and, oh, Jim, he's, you know, he's always making provocative comments, and they just slough it off. So my answer, I think, to Conrad was, although, because I haven't sorted this out yet, that's why I'm here, I'm looking for some help. I think it's essentialist that I'm after, that there has to be a point where we say that incremental changes add up to something qualitatively different.
I guess what I'm saying is even before you can get to this notion of incremental changes, right, you're going to have to educate your basic population. And it's going to have to start with people who have the money to burn for this.
But what would you educate them in? What would you say? There are people they're going to want to do this.
Yeah, there are people who are going to want to do this. If you could have a smarter child, would you not have a smarter child?
Yes. Yes.
You know, my answer, and sort of paraphrase Lionel Penrose, is what kind of horse would you rather have, a race horse or a cart horse? Both horses are useful in their own way. You know, we don't know what kind of horse you're going to need. All of this is not taking into account. I mean, yes, there are imperfections. You look at, I've gone and forgotten. Sickle cell anemia.
Yep.
Right? Look at sickle cell anemia. You know, people can argue, you know, you have both of the genes, you've got a disease, there are issues, it's very important in African and African American populations, mm-hmm. and yet you look at that gene, you know, when it is just one copy instead of two copies, right, and you get a benefit, right, mm-hmm. you gain resistance,
yeah.
resistance from a very nasty disease, right, mm-hmm. From malaria.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know what all of these things are. You know, we're at 25,000 genes, 30,000 genes. I mean, no one gene, one protein makes no sense anymore.
Yes.
The scientists, you know, they know this. They know it's more complex.
But we will know. I want to look ahead and work back from there. We will know. Maybe not 100%, but we'll get close, and then the rest will be risk. The chance that there'll be unintended effects and so on. What I want to know is, is it a matter of we should go this far and no further, or what is it? I mean, let's say, should we say, okay, you can eliminate the disease genes and nothing else. Go ahead.
I'm not going to pretend to try and answer that question, but I want to just add two comments that sort of triangulate here into the conversation. And it takes us back to a comment that Andrea made about being pregnant
yeah.
and being what Raina Rapp calls a moral pioneer, which is a wonderful phrase to remind us that, just as you said, a lot of this Brave New World high-tech stuff really comes down to the level of the bodies and minds and emotions and social worlds of women when they're pregnant. And the two comments that I'd like to make is that one of the things that strikes me in the conversations about, and the question, that the large question about, you know, life, what makes human versus non-human, is that a lot of the trouble that we seem to be in with a definition has some sort of creation story for me and for many others who are feminist researchers and feminists of science, that sort of thing, when reproduction became separated from relationships, from human relationships, and reproduction began to happen outside of women's bodies. And I think that is a possible way to reclaim a perspective on the humanness of it all. The other thing I would say, it, again, is just a comment, is that there's fairly good ethnographic and qualitative research being done by sociologists and anthropologists and a variety of other social scientists, which show quite clearly that pregnant women and their partners are often not seeking the perfect child. That's the media spin on it. They're not seeking the perfect child, they're seeking the perfectly normal child. And that's a really flexible, malleable, expansive concept, and very different than the quest for the perfect child.
I accept that,
yeah. Yeah, and I'm not putting that to you as a critique or anything, but again, just something to kind of remind us that perhaps there is a bit of a checks and balances going on already as this kind of technology is coming out into the larger population, that it turns out that we're not all trying to have the better, faster, bigger, but that we're also trying to just have, you know, kids that make sense to us in the myriad of ways that that happens.
Did you want to?
No. I was just pointing so she could see you.
So. I don't never believe that everyone would do this, but I believe that some people will.
Mm. Yeah, I don't disagree.
And
with that
as
at all.
You know, this story I told about the athletes who were getting in touch with the scientists about where can I get the muscle mass thing. But that changes the situation. They get an advantage. Now what are you going to do? The rest of you. Just say, well, I'm not into that. I'll have a cart horse, not a racehorse. Or do that? Yeah, go ahead.
Just one thing. The last time you made out of a really, for myself, like a really convincing case that from like an industry, from a genetics industry point of view, a lot of these changes are, in fact, genuinely inevitable. Because outside of any social criticism and public discussions, the actual processes of genetic manipulation and, you know, really breaking into the human genetic inheritance already, this inheritance is in fact already in place. And you start this paper by saying, really, in 15 years, you know, this will be a done deal, and perhaps even sooner. And that in terms of thinking about this ethically, in terms of responsibility and risk, we shouldn't really think in the present context, but in fact, just go ahead 15 or 20 years and think what are the actual contexts in which we're thinking, so that in fact, these historical, you know, trans-historical tendencies can be shaped by thinking that really has purchase on the actual material changes in genetic engineering itself. So thinking from that perspective, do you think the central question is, really an essentialist question, as to what constitutes the human versus the non-human, as opposed to what kind of shape will we give to a future of the transhuman? Which, because your whole discussion opens up to this inevitability of the future of the transhuman. I mean, in art, this is being discussed as transgenic beings. So the scientist is looking for a name, unhuman, but the artists already have a name for it. It's transgenics. I can think of a lot of artistic examples of transgenics, and I can think of a lot of sound examples of certain transgenic bodies. There's even composers sitting in this room who have had, you know, really thinking at least at the aesthetic level of what happens when, in fact, things migrate. So do you think that risk analysis should be shaped by, based on attention to how do we shape ethically and creatively the future of the transhuman itself?
That makes me really uneasy. I mean, we live in a world in which most places in the world can't even handle the most elementary questions of human relations. Elementary. I mean, should women be allowed out of the house? Big issue for the Taliban and their friends. Fundamental question, how the enormous Chinese population could ever hope to get a decent government that didn't abuse them. I don't think we can handle this. I honestly don't. We can't even handle much simpler things. How are we going to handle this? I think it will maybe be the breaking point.
I think that, you know, science fiction and fantasy writers have been dealing with this issue for 30 years or more. You know, you can sit down and read Marion Zimmer Bradley, you know, you can read Lois the Master Bejeweled, you can read, a number of them are women science fiction authors, I've noticed that, in, you know, just in my own personal reading. A lot of the stuff has been dealt with, but again, it comes to that small portion of the population that reads these things and is interested. And I am really, really concerned that we're missing the vast majority of the population and that these issues need to be debated. They may be being debated at the highest levels of, you know, the Vatican or, you know, of the theological seminaries or various places, but it's not coming out. People don't know unless it affects them. As a Jew, again, this is one of these things that I am made more aware of. To the best of my knowledge, Tay-Sachs doesn't run in my family, but my sister's getting married and she and her fiancé are getting tested, right? They need to know whether or not either of them is a carrier. Mm-hmm. And then that will affect whether or not they have to get, you know, prenatal diagnosis done, mm-hmm. you know, if and when she gets pregnant. Mm-hmm. These are things that communities have been dealing with in various ways, sub-communities. How to decide whether something's human or not human, that's a big issue that we just haven't, whether it's because of, you know, that divide between the sciences and the arts, right? Whether it's because of that, I can't say. But institutions have an ability to change some of these things. And I think, really, that it's going to have to come mandated down from someplace. Because what are you going to do? You're going to say, sorry, you can't do that? Well, you know, Southeast Asia is letting people go ahead with cloning now and stem cell research. And, you know, it was just in the New Scientist, a lot of expats have been, you know, going there because they can do a lot more in Indonesia and in South Korea than they can do in the States or in Canada. And so, yeah, it's a global economy, and people will travel and do these things. And, you know, can you mandate a stop to it, and mandate mandated a stop to genetic engineering in the 70s? I don't think we can do that now. I really don't. The cat's out of the bag. The only thing we can do, I think, is to educate the population, you know, to make it something that they're going to have to think of. Is this something I want to do? You know, I've got to tell you that the germline, changing germline gives me the massive heebie-jeebies, you know, making that kind of choice, because you can't call it back. It's done.
Okay.
It's done. It's out there. There is no going back.
So, tell me, what would you do?
As I said, you know, I'd mandate certain courses, right? That you know, I would mandate that science students, particularly those in genetics and microbiology, should have to take an ethics class, you know, maybe make them, you know, read some of these books that some of the authors have said, this is where you could go. We're not seeing it so much coming from within the communities anymore, right? I mean, Penrose had a very strong take on these things. Haldane had a very strong feeling about where you should be going and where you shouldn't be going. And then we had Hitler, and it kind of went home, right? So, the leftists got their very fast example in the late 1930s and the 1940s of, you know, where eugenics can go and be used very, very incorrectly. And here we are again with the new eugenics. And I'm not seeing people come out and talk about this to an educated public, because the public doesn't know. So, you know, whether that means mandating stuff to elementary school, you know, to the high school students, whether it means throwing in a class, you have to do 3 units of this, you know, genetic engineering for the 21st century, and everybody's got to take a class. That would honestly be my suggestion. At the very least, it would sensitize them to the issues, even if it was just like taking your English class, you know, and you run through the basis. It's the only thing I've got to suggest. Because they're interested if they find out about it. At least that's what I found with my own students.